Welcome to this Ufula audio production of The Lone Ranger Rides by Fran Stryker, Volume 4, Chapter 10, The Lone Ranger. It was daybreak when the man in the cave wakened in surprise to find that he had slept the night through. The fragrant aroma of coffee and bacon crisping on a fire made him realize that he was ready for a solid meal. Tonto looked up from his cooking and grinned. The Texan felt of his wounded shoulder. He was amazed at the way the swelling had completely disappeared. He could even move his arm without too much pain. He felt alive this morning. He stood. He was a bit unsteady, but his wounded foot could bear his weight, thanks to the manner in which Tonto had bandaged it. Sunlight streamed past the opening of the cave and turned the gap bright and cheerful. Cold water dashed into his face made the ranger wide awake. He felt his three-day growth of beard and turned to Tonto. "I must look like a desert rat," he said ruefully.
"That's easy to fix. How do you feel?"
"First rate, Tonto, thanks to you." Tonto beamed and dished up fresh eggs with the bacon.
"Today you're going to get even better."
Food never tasted finer than breakfast did. When it was finished, the Indian produced the ranger's duffel, which included not only shaving materials, but fresh clothing. While the Texan pulled off the mud and blood-stained remnants of the clothing he'd been wearing and bathed in the cool stream, the Indian told how he had buried the men in the canyon during the night. He explained that he'd made 6 fresh graves, though only 5 were dead. Whoever visited the scene of the battle, and no one from the basin had yet done so, might wonder who had done the burying, but the impression would be given that all 6 of the rangers had died. The trail would clearly show that only 6 men had ridden there, and 6 lay buried. There would be no search for a survivor who might carry back to town the news of the massacre. The far-sighted Indian had destroyed the trail made by the one who lived as he had crept from the scene. The identity of the wounded man was buried in an empty grave. The ranger saw the wisdom in Tonto's scheme. So far, he had no idea who the killers were. If they knew he had survived, they would hunt him down while he had no conception of their identity. With the killers misguided into false security, he would be left unmolested as long as he wasn't recognized as a Texas Ranger. When he had finished dressing in clean clothes and boots that Tonto had brought, the Texan sat beside the stream to think. Tonto busied himself about the cave, showing a tact and understanding that was rare in any man. The Indian seemed to know that the Texan wanted to be left alone. He waited to answer what questions might be asked. The Texan's eyes fell upon a small black book that was on the gravel at his side. It lay open to the flyleaf, and there was an inscription penned in the fine handwriting that engravers try so hard to copy. The man picked up the Bible and looked at his mother's words. "To my son, with all my love and a prayer that he will carry with him always the lessons we studied together." He remembered candlelit evenings at his mother's side in the pioneer home. He recalled the time when he had memorized the 10 commandments, reciting them, then listening to his father's interpretations of the original laws of living as applied to life in the New West. Those laws had seemed so simple, yet so all-embracing. His father had said that life was supposed to be simple, and that only man-made laws complicated things. Man-made laws failed so often. As a Texas Ranger, he had seen rich murderers freed by juries, while poor men were jailed interminably for stealing food to ward off the death of their starving children. Man-made laws could not be relied upon to serve the highest form of justice. He thought of his 5 comrades, now buried in an isolated gap. What law could punish their murderers? How could he find those murderers? And having found them, what proof would there be against them? Thou shalt not kill. That was the law. Yet who was there to find and punish those who had already killed 5 brave men? He knew something of the Cavendish clan. In the basin there were men who would probably give false testimony. There was unlimited money to be spent in bribes if needed. There was Bryant Cavendish, a law unto himself. Against these forces he stood alone and practically helpless. In spite of the odds against his success, the Texan found himself breathing a silent pledge to the souls of his friends. "I'll find the ones who did it," he whispered, "and I'll see them made to pay in full." Even as he spoke, he knew of another pledge he'd made, a pledge to his mother that he'd mind the precepts that he'd learned. One of those was, "Thou shalt not kill." While pledged not to kill, he had to confront hard men to whom murder was a mere detail in a day's work. When and if the showdown came, after he found the murderers he sought, it would probably be a case of kill or be killed. He didn't mind dying if it would serve his ends, but his own death would in no way avenge the lives of his friends. Neither would it serve the cause of justice by ridding the country of inglorious ravagers. He found himself considering the things in his favor. The fact that he had survived the fight was known only to himself and Tonto. He would not be recognized because of his horse. The only other men who knew about the white stallion were dead. He could change his appearance by disguise if necessary. He wondered if these last few days hadn't already changed his looks. He felt he must have aged considerably. His outlook on life was certainly changed. He no longer felt like the carefree ranger. He felt older, more serious, more grim. He rose to his feet and called, "Tonto." The Indian advanced. In his hand there were guns, holsters, and a heavy cartridge belt.
"Maybe now you'll look at your guns."
The Texan recognized the brace of perfectly matched and balanced revolvers. "My own," he said. Tonto nodded.
"After you fell, another ranger took your guns. I found them near the fight."
The weight of the belt on his hips was good. It gave the man a feeling of competence. He drew the guns and spun them by the trigger guard. Reflected light splashed off the spinning weapons. Then the butts dropped in his palms and the guns were steady. With those weapons, the ranger had ridden a fast horse at top speed and kept a tin can bouncing ahead of him with bullets. He could, and frequently he had done it, restrain his draw until fast gunslingers had their own weapons free of the holster and still get the drop on them. He broke one of the guns and dumped the cartridges into the palm of his hand.
"You loaded them, huh, Tonto?"
Tonto nodded. There was something about the cartridges. They gleamed brilliantly. He studied them a moment and then looked questioningly at the Indian.
"Those bullets are silver."
And it was true. The bullets and the cartridges were solid, hard silver. The Texan looked puzzled.
"That makes for pretty high-press shooting," he said. "You don't shoot much,"
Tonto replied. Then he explained how the precious metal for the bullets had come from the Texan's own silver mine. Tonto himself had cast the metal. The white man marveled at the complete knowledge Tonto had of him and his affairs. Then Tonto brought a mask from beneath his buckskin shirt. It was black and fashioned to cover the entire upper part of a man's face, effectively concealing all identity.
"Wear this," Tonto suggested.
The white man hesitated.
"If I go around wearing a mask, the law is going to be in full chase of me in no time," he said.
Tonto nodded.
"Yes, and you will be hunting outlaws."
Birds of a feather. By concealing his identity with the mask, his disguise would serve a second purpose. It would mark him in such a way that outlaws might welcome his company, and thus put him in possession of information otherwise impossible to secure.
"The other rangers are all dead,"
said Tonto as the white man tried the mask and found it a perfect fit.
"You're the only ranger now. You're all alone."
"All alone," repeated the other man softly.
"Except for you, Tonto. Seems it's your plan for us to travel together."
Tonto nodded slowly, soberly. He held out his brown hand again. In the palm there was a metal badge. It was the Texas Ranger's badge. The white man took it and looked at it and closed his fist about it tightly.
"The Texas Rangers," he said softly, "are dead.
All six of them have gone. In their place, there's just one man. The Lone Ranger. He put the badge deep in his pocket and murmured again, "The Lone Ranger." Chapter 11. The Lone Ranger Rides. The Lone Ranger kept the mask across his eyes and experimented with his guns. His shoulder made it hard for him to draw the gun on his left, but he found that his smooth speed seemed to have suffered no loss when he drew the other shining weapon. As a test, he unloaded and holstered the pistol. "I'll just make sure," he muttered to Tonto. Standing with his right hand straight before him, palm down, he placed a pebble on the back of his hand. He dropped the hand with almost invisible speed, jerked out the gun, leveled it, snapped the hammer back, and then down. All this was done before the pebble touched the ground. Tonto grinned at the demonstration and said, "That'll do." The masked man sat down and replaced the cartridges in his gun cylinder. "So, we're going to travel together?" he said. Tonto nodded slowly. The Lone Ranger liked the idea. Tonto's unequaled knowledge of woodcraft and his animal-like skill in following a trail that was invisible to white men would make him a powerful ally. Tonto told about the cattle trails he'd found beyond the top of Thunder Mountain, and the trail that led from the mountain's top to the clearing and beyond into the basin. He told of his suspicions that stolen cattle were harbored in the basin. When the masked man asked where Tonto had secured the food he'd brought, the Indian evaded answering. His pride had suffered when he had been compelled to ask a girl to help him. He felt just a little bit like many of the vagrant begging Indians that were so despised in certain parts of the country. Nothing but the urgent need of a friend would have prompted Tonto to request those favors, and he fully intended some day to wipe out the obligation. The Lone Ranger didn't press the point. Tonto did, however, answer many questions that had bothered the masked man when he explained how he had happened to find the cave. He had heard shots in the gap and gone toward the sound. Scrambling down a rocky side of the canyon in the dark, he had seen a white horse dimly outlined in the darkness. He hadn't then suspected that the horse was Silver, but instinctively he had sounded the bird-like trill that Silver knew. When the big stallion came to Tonto's side, he saw that there was no equipment behind the saddle and assumed that Silver was alone. He had led Silver into hiding until dawn. When he followed the back trail to the scene of the murder, there were signs there that showed that one man had gone wounded from the scene. He followed then the blood-marked trail until he came to the cave. "Simple as all that," the masked man commented when Tonto finished his recital. "If I hadn't been so nearly unconscious, I'd have recognized your whistle." The two spent most of the forenoon making plans and preparations. The masked man's wound still bothered him, but he felt equal to a long ride, and he was eager to get started in his investigation. He wore the mask continually, so it would become a familiar part of him, and not something strange that hampered his movements. After their noon meal, the two were ready, with their duffel loaded on the backs of Scout and Silver. The white horse seemed eager to be in action once again with his master in the saddle. He whinnied jubilantly when the cinch was pulled tightly, and his great strength showed in every rippling muscle beneath his snow-white coat. Tonto mounted Scout and then waited. The Lone Ranger placed one foot in the stirrup and shouted, "Hi-yo, Silver!" The big horse lunged ahead. "Away!" The ringing, clear voice cried as the masked man settled in the saddle. Silver was a white flame leaping ahead, with silky mane and tail blown straight out by the wind, like the plumes of a knight in white armor. Sharp hooves hammered on the hard rocks in a tattoo that thrilled like rolling drums. Silver had his master in the saddle, Tonto close behind him. The master's voice rang out again to echo both ways in the canyon. "Hi-yo, Silver! Away!" Tonto watched from his saddle close behind the mighty Silver and whispered, "Now the Lone Ranger rides." A stretch of flat tableland extended for several miles between the rim of the gap and the foot of Thunder Mountain. After that first thrilling dash, the Lone Ranger slowed Silver to let Tonto take the lead and set the route. The Indian knew exactly where to go to reach the mountain's top without passing through the basin. The masked man was now strong enough for great activity, but Tonto anticipated none for the time being. The purpose of this trip was merely one of observation. The Indian intended to point out cattle trails he'd seen and study them. In so doing, he and the Lone Ranger would get further away from the danger of the cave's proximity to the basin killers. Tonto felt sure that the ride wouldn't overtax the masked man. He knew his white friend was perfectly at home in the big saddle, and perhaps far more comfortable than he'd been chafing with inactivity in that cave. After an hour or so of riding, the ground became more rocky and difficult. Just ahead, the mountain rose majestically. Thunder Mountain didn't divulge her secret dangers. At first, the ground sloped only gently upward, with an occasional large tree that gave soft shade. Like a seductress in green, the mountain lured the stranger on with promises of things that were ahead. The trees became more frequent. Then larger trees with tangled vines in close embrace made travel harder. As the climb became steeper, leafy discards, which had rotted to soft loam, gave birth to rank weeds. The inclination increased so gradually that one wasn't aware that it was changing. The Lone Ranger realized quite suddenly that his horse was laboring. The weeds had become a crazy tangle, merging with vines that hung from overhead like spectral streamers. There was a constant clammy caress of invisible cobwebs on the Lone Ranger's face, and the less subtle, sometimes painful brushing of tree trunks against his thighs. Silver's coat became blood-flecked where briars and brambles raked his skin. The riders had frequently to crouch or to be swept from the saddle by low, far-reaching branches. None but Tonto could possibly have followed this weird and devious route. Daylight in the woods was at best twilight. Human intrusion brought a constant cacophony of cries and chattered complaints from birds and beasts. No breeze could possibly penetrate this fastness, and the breath of the decaying things was hot and fetid as it rose from the ground. The most distant horizon was within arm's reach. Underbrush, so high that it reached overhead, rose from slime that was sometimes ankle-deep. The ride seemed endless, but the end came without warning. Breaking through a particularly dense cover of berry canes with briars that hurt, the riders found it clear ahead. The land was hard and almost arid. A thought made the masked man smile despite his exhaustion. Old Thunder Mountain needn't be so proud. Her head was bald. Wind and rain had swept the summit clean except for a few gaunt stumps of lightning-blasted trees. Tonto was at the masked man's side, offering to help him from the saddle.
"Now we rest," he said. "You need lots of rest."
"I can go on, Tonto. It's good to be riding again."
Tonto shook his head.
"No, we stop here. You need to rest, and I need to talk to you."
Chapter 12. A Legal Paper. In the clear air, one could see for miles from the top of Thunder Mountain. The basin, most of it at least, was hidden by the foliage, but the view in the opposite direction encompassed endless plains that led to ranches beyond the horizon. The masked man wondered how many of those ranches had contributed to the crisscrossing of cattle tracks on the bald dome where he stood. Tonto pointed out the things that he'd observed on previous visits and indicated where a trail had been cut to make a descent straight into the basin. Meanwhile, most of the people in the basin went to Becky's funeral. It was a simple ceremony without tears, conducted by Jeb Cavendish. No one who had known Rebecca's life could feel sorry for her having been released. Penny held the hands of the oldest children during the burial. She frequently felt the eyes of Yuma, standing unhatted with a number of other men upon her, but each time she looked at the blonde cowboy, he was staring at the ground. Vince was there, and so were most of the cowhands. Wally was somewhere away from the basin. Brian had a distant view from his seat on the porch of the house. Mort was still in bed with a bandage around his neck. Jeb seemed to enjoy his brief period as the center of attraction, and postponed conclusion of the services as long as possible. When he ultimately pronounced a benediction, Yuma hurried away as if on important business. Penny led the dry-eyed youngsters toward the house. Gimlet, the cook, advanced to meet her.
"Let me take care of the youngies, Miss Penny," the old man said. "Gee ripes, I ain't had a chance to tell a pack of lies to kids since you growed up."
Penny was grateful. The children had been her responsibility since Rebecca's death, and she welcomed the chance to get away and think for a while.
"I'll be around when you have to start supper," she said.
"Don't you do it now, Miss Penny. Don't you do nothing of the sort. You leave the kids with me and let them stick by me. It'll do them good to talk to someone size them glum-acting cousins of yours with their souls full of vinegar till it shows in their faces."
Penny smiled.
"It's a deal, Gimlet. They're your responsibility. Till bedtime."
The children heretofore ignored were wide-eyed at the thought that anybody would actually want their company. Gimlet's manner seemed forced. Penny fancied her old friend had worries about which he said nothing.
"You get now,"
he said, spanking the oldest boy playfully.
"I'll be right along and meet you by the kitchen door."
When the children had gone, the old man with one eye turned to Penelope.
"I got something to tell you."
"Yes, Gimlet?"
"I've only got one eye, but my ears is first rate. Maybe I ought to keep my big mouth shut, but I figure you ought to know that your Uncle Bryant is up to something."
"Uncle Bryant?"
Penny's tone showed her surprise. She knew that Gimlet was one friend upon whom she could count. The old cook had dandled her on his knee when, as a child, she had come to live in the basin. She listened eagerly.
"Heard him talking to a no-good, gambling, smooth-talking hombre named Lonergan."
Penny remembered that Lonergan had called the night before. Brian had taken him upstairs behind closed doors.
"Curiosity has always been my trouble, and when I heard talking between them two, I didn't shut my ears none. Couldn't get much of what was said, but the two of them was working over some sort of legal paper."
"What about it?"
asked Penny.
"Uncle Brian has a right to make a contract or agreement with anybody he wants."
"Well, all I know is I heard Brian ask Lonergan if he was dead sure the paper stand in court after he was dead and gone."
Penny wanted to laugh at Gimlet's obvious concern over what was probably his will. His seriousness, however, impressed her.
"That ain't all. I heard more. Heard Brian saying he wanted to leave what he owed to them that deserved it, and he didn't want none of his damn relatives contesting the will in court of law."
"But after all, Gimlet, it's Uncle Bryant's ranch, and he can do whatever he wants with it."
"Another thing," growled Gimlet, "they's a puncher here calling himself Yuma."
"What about him?"
"You can trust that big maverick, Miss Penny. He thinks a heap about you."
Penny said nothing. Gimlet went on with a lengthy discourse about the fine qualities of Yuma. He and Yuma had spent hours in close confab in the kitchen, and Yuma had expressed his feelings confidentially to Gimlet. Penny's face grew red as the frank old man continued. Finally, she cut him off.
"Those children are waiting for you, Gimlet."
"All right, I'm a-goin' to 'em. But you just remember Yuma's ace-high with me, and you're ace-high with him."
Gimlet shuffled toward the kitchen door. Penny wanted to get away from the surroundings and be alone with her thoughts. She had at least 2 hours before her uncle would be expecting her for the evening meal. Hurriedly, she changed to riding clothes and left the vicinity on Las Vegas. She discounted the seriousness of all that Gimlet had said about her uncle's legal paper. Obviously just a will. The thing that concerned her most was the truth about Bryant's eyes. During the day, she had tried to observe him carefully. There were times when she was sure he had trouble seeing things. Then she thought he had truly fired at Mort. But failing eyes had made his shot go wild, and coincidence had made it drill Yuma's hat. There were other times when Bryant seemed to reach directly without a trace of groping for whatever he desired, and then she wondered. There was no doubt in her mind that Vince and Mort were involved in something or other that they didn't want too generally known. What of the men, the Texas Rangers, who Becky had said came to investigate and died for it? Lost in her thoughts, the girl rode on without thought or direction. She let the reins hang slack and paid no attention to the tangle of growing things that brushed past her. She was surprised when she came back to reality to find that Las Vegas had carried her up Thunder Mountain. She was well beyond the lower part of the path where it was rough.
"Well, I might as well keep going now," she said.
There was sugar in her pocket put there for Las Vegas. Well, this time the Mustang could do without his customary sweet. She'd save it till she reached the clearing and see if she could bribe attention from that silver stallion.
That Indian, though, what did he call himself? Tonto, that was it.
Tonto had said that a friend was wounded. She wondered if by any chance this friend could be one of the Texas Rangers. She thought it quite unlikely in view of the fact that all of them were said to have been killed. Well, she'd ask Tonto anyway.
The clearing was just ahead. She saw the form of a horse through the trees, and then a man. His back was toward her. She saw him turning as he heard the hooves approach. The man was not her Indian friend. Neither was he a stranger to the girl. He was one of the last people in the world she cared to meet in such a place. He was the killer, who called himself Rangoon. Chapter 13. Help Wears a Mask. Penny couldn't turn back without making herself appear ridiculous. Rangoon had already seen her and was grinning a welcome. He took his hat off with a flourish and revealed black hair, parted low on one side and plastered down upon his forehead with a carefully nurtured dip. His hair gleamed from greasy stuff that he used on it.
"Well," he said with the air of a welcoming host, "this is a downright surprise."
Penny halted at the edge of the clearing. It was the first time she had seen Rangoon at close range, and she found him wholly repugnant. His face was pitted from smallpox, scarred from a knife brawl, and generally greasy with sweat. But it was his eyes that made him hideous. They were small and bloodshot and set too close together. He had only one eyebrow, which extended clear across the ridge of his receding forehead, serving both eyes. The expression in the eyes was one of confidence and insolence. Instinctively, Penny felt that she should turn at once and ride back home. Rangoon advanced on foot and held a hand toward her.
"I'll help you down from the saddle," he said.
"I'm not dismounting. I was just about to turn back."
"I don't reckon you'll want to turn back right here now," Rangoon said. "There's something over here you'll be right glad to have a look at."
"I doubt it."
Penny tried to jerk the reins around, but Rangoon was holding them.
"Please let go of my reins, Rangoon. I'm going home."
Rangoon shook his head slowly.
"I wouldn't if I was you. I understand that your uncle would be right sore if he found out you'd rid up here, in spite of all that he said about it."
Penny pulled suddenly and hard, but vainly.
"It ain't no use trying to pull free just yet,"
Rangoon advised her.
"Because I aim to have you take just one look at what I seen. Then you're free to go, if you want to."
Penny was armed. She wore a small caliber revolver on a belt around her waist. She felt that she could use this if necessary. She was more angry than frightened. She dismounted, ignoring the offered hand of the pockmarked man. He shrugged his shoulders as if to say it didn't matter. She noticed that his own horse was tethered to a nearby tree.
"What is it that you want to show me?"
"I suppose you're downright disappointed that it's me you see here instead of your other friend,"
Rangoon said slowly. Penny noticed the use of the word "other." It implied that in his mind Rangoon had no intention of considering himself in the humble position of a waddy on her uncle's ranch, but rather as one on an equal social footing. Penny made no comment.
"You wonder how I know about him, eh?"
Rangoon said.
"Well, there's what I want you to see."
He pointed to the ground. Penny saw the marks of her small boots clearly showing where she had stood yesterday. Nearby were the prints that Tonto's moccasins had made. Penny stared and felt herself growing cold with fury at the realization of what she knew must be in Rangoon's foul mind. Not only were the prints there together, but both pairs led toward the lean-to.
"'Tain't as if it was one of the boys from the basin,"
the tantalizing voice behind her said.
but a critter wearing moccasins, that might mean a redskin.
Penny acted instinctively. She whirled quickly and swung with all the force of her arm. Her gloved hand smacked against the scar on Rangoon's cheek. Then she burned with embarrassment. Any explanation would be futile. She walked quickly toward her horse.
Not so fast,
Rangoon said sharply, grabbing Penny's arm.
You let go of my arm, or I'll shoot you.
I don't think you will.
In that instant, Penny was ready to kill. All reasoning had left her. The hand on her arm brought her fury to white heat. She snatched for her gun, but Rangoon slapped the weapon from her hand. Rangoon released his grip on her arm and caught up the reins of her horse.
Just get to your senses while I tie up your horse, then we'll talk.
Released, the girl made a dive for her gun, which was on the ground. Rangoon saw the motion and put his foot on the weapon.
I'll fix that,
he growled. He picked up the gun and emptied it of cartridges.
Now you can have the shooting iron back,
he said, handing it to her while he tossed the ammunition deep among the heavy brush. Penny took her weapon mechanically and put it back empty in her holster. Fear gripped her for a moment when she realized that she was practically helpless. To turn and race away on foot now would be a futile gesture. She thought of fainting, but that wouldn't help matters any. She looked defiantly at Rangoon.
What do you want to talk about?
Now that's more like it. You don't need to be scared of me. I don't aim to hurt you none.
There was a definite sneer in both the voice and expression while the man tossed Las Vegas's reins about a tree and nodded them.
Don't forget the notion that you gotta fight for your honor and all that sort of tripe, like in the reading books. I don't aim to get shot up by men in the basin for making passes at you. I like my women without no killing fights tied onto them.
Penny stubbornly refused to let her face indicate her feelings. She stood chin up, listening.
First of all, I hankered to know why you all rid up here.
It's none of your business.
Going to be stubborn again, eh? Well, you'll get home a sight quicker if you answer my questions.
Why are you here?
Countered Penny.
That's easy. I tell, then you tell.
Rangoon grinned.
Making a sort of game of it, eh? Well, yesterday I seen smoke coming out of the treetops. I wondered who was camping up here, but couldn't get away from the basin to see. I done rid up here today and found some downright interesting footprints. Now it's your turn to tell just what they mean.
And then you'll let me leave here?
Talk first.
I used to ride up this way before I went to school. I came up yesterday and found a friendly Indian camped here.
Why?
How do I know?
You done rid up here twice.
Penny hadn't credited Rangoon with such skill at reading signs.
Yes, I came up twice.
Redskin had two horses with him. What about them?
Penny, while hating herself for enduring the man's insolence, felt that there was no use in trying to evade the truth, which, after all, was harmless. She told Rangoon about bringing food for the Indian's friend. When she mentioned the friend, Rangoon showed keen interest.
Who was that there friend?
I don't know.
Where was he at?
I don't know that either. I've told you all that I know, Rangoon.
The man shook his head slowly.
That ain't enough. I got to know the rest.
Penny was defiant.
I've told you all I know, and now I'm starting back for the basin. If I'm not there, Uncle Brian is going to wonder why, and I'll tell him why I was delayed. You ought to know him pretty well, Rangoon. He won't take this sort of behavior from you.
Rangoon threw back his head and laughed hard at this.
Your uncle won't hurt me,
he said between two roars of laughter. Penny made a sudden dive for the knotted reins. Again, Rangoon was quicker. He caught her in his strong hands.
You ain't leaving yet. Did you tell me who the Redskin's friend is, and where he's hiding?
I tell you, I don't know.
Penny struggled to free herself.
I'll wring it out of you then.
Rangoon bellowed as he wrapped his long arms completely around the girl and nearly cut off her wind in a bear-like grip.
Let me go,
gasped Penny. Rangoon's grip was tighter. His arms were crushing the slim girl to him, bending her back until it hurt frightfully. His ugly face was close to her, his breath foul with alcohol, and half-rotted teeth was hot. Penny felt nauseated, violently ill. Contact with the girl made Rangoon reckless. He seemed to have forgotten any fear he might have had. His voice was hoarse as he shouted to Penny,
"Who is that Indian friend of yours?"
His repeated question was simply an excuse to hold the girl. His voice was hoarse.
"Who is that Indian friend?"
"I am."
It was a new voice, a deeply resonant one that spoke from behind Rangoon.
"Stand back,"
the same voice snapped. Rangoon swore and whirled as he snatched out his gun with cat-like speed and agility. The releasing of the girl, the turning, the drawing, and the firing all seemed part of one smooth, flowing movement that came from instinct. Wide-eyed, Penny saw Rangoon's gun jump as it lashed flame and smoke toward the newcomer. The gun seemed a thing alive. It leapt free of Rangoon's hand and flew in an arc across the clearing. Rangoon screamed a livid curse of pain as he gripped his gun hand. The stranger, standing 10 feet away, had his own weapon back in its holster. Penny saw that the man was tall. His hat was white and clean, and his face was masked. Rangoon's hand must have hurt terribly to judge from his violent cursing. Penny had a dazed, detached feeling as she watched the two men. Rangoon, still cursing, held a hand that stung from the force of the bullet that had knocked his own gun away. The stranger with the mask stepped forward and slapped Rangoon in the face. The blow did not appear to be hard swung, but it sent Rangoon sprawling to the ground.
"That's enough of that talk,"
the stranger said in his crisp but nonetheless pleasant voice. Penny heard another sound and turned as Tonto came from behind the trees. The masked man spoke again.
"You're not hurt badly. My bullet struck your gun, not your hand."
"You'll pay for this," Rangoon cried. "I'll see you shot up, a little at a time. I'll have my men get you. You just wait."
The Lone Ranger turned to Tonto.
"You'd better gag him, Tonto," he said. "It's going to be hard to talk above that noise."
Tonto grinned and leapt astride Rangoon, who made no attempt to rise from the ground. What the killer said was muffled as Tonto jammed a knotted cloth into his mouth.
"When he's gagged, rope him."
Tonto nodded, his expression set, gladly. Penny watched with interest. She knew she should mount and ride at once for the basin, but there was something about the masked man that held her, and there were things she wanted to ask. Who was the stranger whose chin was so well shaped? Why was he masked? She instinctively liked him. Aside from the help he'd given her, she liked his efficient manner of handling Rangoon. Beyond the tree, she caught a glimpse of Silver. This, then, was the man to whom she had sent food, the man for whom Tonto had asked help. This was the owner of the magnificent stallion.
"Friend," she thought. "That's who he is, Tonto's friend."
She remembered the way Tonto had spoken of him, and then finally understood the tone that the Indian had used when he said, "My friend."